The next talk is entitled Current Surgical Algorithm for Chronic Pancreatitis by Mark Marshall Baker, who just moved to Loyola, which you may know as the original home of Charles Pustow, famous for the name given to the procedure, the Pustow procedure.
Thank you, Dr. Nealon. I'm going to speak to you today about surgery for chronic pancreatitis, and the word algorithm was in the title, and I left it out because I don't think there are really well-defined algorithms for how to manage these patients. I think we really tend to individualize them, as Greg, I think, pointed out very clearly. I've got no disclosures. I'm going to talk broadly about how we sort of approach these patients from a surgical point of view to give you some sense for how we make decisions about them, and try not to put a bunch of slides up there with lines leading from one place to the next. The first point that I wanted to make was just something that I've learned through experience over the last 10 or 12 years, which is that managing this is a lot about managing addiction. Whether or not patients have alcohol leading to pancreatitis and you're managing the alcohol addiction, or they've got pancreatitis leading to pain, leading to chronic pain addiction, you're managing people who have addiction problems. And if you can't get that done in any way which is material, you're going to fail in your therapy, and you shouldn't be taking patients to the operating room. I think it's a topic for another day. You could spend days talking about it, but I think if you don't do it, you will not succeed.
Usually it's the gastroenterologist talk that gets sabotaged.
This reminded me why I like surgery for pancreatitis. Minimize the technology. We use Bovian sutures. Mm-hmm.
Reboot. Losing the audience.
Can I plug my computer?
Can we do that?
While we're sitting here, if anyone wants to jump up and make a comment or two or ask a question, you can do that while we're waiting. Anyone? Bueller? Are there any endoscopists in the room? Yay. Yeah, I saw him. Good. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, in the corner.
I'm not an endoscopist. Thank you. Chavagai, this is from University of Buffalo. We looked at the first two presentations, and the importance of not letting the disease go too far has been emphasized. Yet in surgery, you know, frequently we get input from our colleagues or senior partner. Sometimes you get the input of don't rush this patient to the operating room, try to figure out what's going on. So where is that sweet point of where we're not really burning through everything, all the islet cells before we intervene versus not intervening, you know, too late or too early?
Logged out with the window.
From a surgical standpoint.
Log into Windows 10, PS at ease, or...
Yeah, I unfortunately have quite strong feelings about the interface of what I call classic chronic pancreatitis with large ducts and stones, and whether those should go to TPIAT or not. Perfect. My view is they shouldn't. I actually published data many, many years ago showing that early drainage actually results in preservation of function. So there's some reasons to go in and not wait till their end stage. But the magnitude of the TPIT, I agree, makes it a much bigger decision when that's the right operation. And there is times where that's the right operation, of course.
Thank you.
This one here.
The question I have is for gastroenterologist. As you know, more you manipulate the pancreatic duct, more chances of acute pancreatitis. What is the incidence of acute pancreatitis after manipulation for chronic pancreatitis for stone or ESWL?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the last part of that? I didn't catch that.
What is the incidence of acute pancreatitis?
One second, I was getting some background noise here. Go ahead, speak up, please.
What is the incidence of acute pancreatitis after ESWL or manipulation of the pancreatic duct for stones?
Yeah, so the obviously with ERCP we worry about iatrogenic pancreatitis. What we see after treatment of local complications like main duct stones or pseudocysts and so on are really local complications of the procedure. So it's secondary infection of a fluid collection, it's development of a pseudocyst from the trauma of dilating and basically pulling the stone out. We don't see the classic, you know, lipase elevation to more than threefold with new onset pain. It's a different process, so it's not classic acute pancreatitis. The overall likelihood of a complication is, it really is case by case dependent. It depends on what we're trying to accomplish and what the, you know, location of the obstruction is, but I'd estimate it's about 10%. And most of those complications are relatively short-lived, meaning a few days in the hospital without more procedures.
I think we're ready to jump back to Dr. Marshall Baker. Sorry for the delay.
That's okay, I appreciate your patience. So beyond, you know, addiction, once you have a patient where you feel like you've got the addiction controlled, you've got someone who can work with therapists and regulate those kind of behavioral problems, what we end up doing as surgeons is try to, as Greg alluded to, match sort of the morphology of the disease with the procedure that we think is right for them. Selecting from a relatively small number of surgical options, and then we participate in a decision about when to do it, you know, considering all of the myriad of endoscopic therapies that have developed over the past few years. What I was going to do now is sort of run through some of our surgical options, highlighting the ones that I find are most helpful now, and go through indications for them and some tips about how we do them. You know, when you talk about surgical options and matching them with the gland morphology, we have basically three broad categories of procedure. There are drainage procedures, which are the classic Partington-Rochelle lateral pancreatic jejunostomy. There are resection procedures, Whipple's distal pancreatectomies, and Baeger operations. And then there are hybrid operations, which involve some form of resection in the gland and drainage of the pancreatic duct, the Fry, Burn, and Hisbicki procedures. The Whipple is probably the one that's most familiar to everyone. From my point of view, I think the indications for this are a patient which has head dominant disease and you have some concern for has superimposed cancer and or biliary stricturing. Whipple has the capacity to provide excellent palliation for patients like this. It gives you definitive management of a potential cancer, but it carries with it substantial risk of SMV, SMA injury, and then potential pancreatic insufficiency following the procedure. The sort of tips about Whipple, I think, for the audience is that if you're going into the operating room intending to do this, you really have to, in my mind, be ready to and be able to change your plan when you're in there. There's just cases that you're going to get into thinking that you're going to do a Whipple and you just can't do it. You can't find the GDA because it's stuck in a sea of fibrosis. You can't get the pancreatic neck off the SMV safely. You simply just cannot do the operation technically. And you have to come up with another plan. You have to be able to do one of the alternatives that we're going to talk about in a little bit. When you're doing it, I think some of the keys are getting out of the operating room without a vascular injury. And it's sounds obvious, but it is a technical feat in some of these patients. And you know, some things that I feel like I've learned is to minimize the technology and to really go back to sort of traditional ways of dividing the uncinate so that you are careful about not injuring the SMA. With regard to the second resectional procedure, the Baeger operation evolved after Whipple was coming to prominence and was developed by Hans Baeger in an attempt to spare the duodenum in patients who felt like didn't need to have duodenectomies. It has the potential to palliate the disease. It also gives you a reasonable diagnosis of cancer, but it involves the dissection again of the pancreatic neck off of the SMV and it carries with it significant risk of SMV injury. With this one, you basically divide the neck of the pancreas and rotate the head out of the retroperitoneum and resect the head in almost totality, leaving a small rim with the bile duct going through it. And so technical pearls about this one, I think, also, again, have to do with avoiding vascular injury and then avoiding biliary injury. You have to really make, I think, every effort to remove the disease in the pancreatic head in total, so that you don't end up with recurrent pancreatitis in the remnant that's left on the duodenum. One of the tricks I think there is to use cholangiocatheters, which you can place through the cystic duct in some of these patients to give you a tactile sense of where the bile duct is. And there are questions with this one about leak rates because you essentially have two anastomoses. You have an anastomosis at the pancreatic neck and you have an anastomosis at the remnant of the pancreatic head. the leak rates with this operation are very low, but it's something that I think requires some attention to that longer pancreatic ejectionostomy at the head remnant. And the hybrid procedures, I think, are the ones that we are falling back to more frequently in the surgical world. I don't know exactly why that is. You don't see a lot of people that need a simple lateral pancreatic ejectionostomy, at least in my mind anymore. Maybe that's because of the advent of successful endotherapies. The hybrid procedure that I think we use more often is the burn operation, which was developed by Baeger's descendants in Europe, Marcus Buechler among them. And it involves coring out the pancreatic head without doing a neck dissection. It provides excellent palliation, it minimizes your pancreatectomy and your potential for exocrine insufficiency, and it minimizes your risk of vascular injury. I do think there is risk of vascular injury. You can still get into the SMV with this operation, and if you do, you're into it inside your core cavity of the pancreatic head, and it's a hard problem to fix, I can tell you from experience. The other, I think, bleeding potential with this operation is a little higher than others. You end up with a cavity that is not as well controlled in terms of potential for bleeding from SMA branches and branches from the GDA in the pancreatic head, as is the case in the Baeger operation. So tricks with this one, you want to get your core cavity to be big enough. If you do not do that, you're going to leave disease behind and have recurrent pancreatitis. You don't necessarily want to go through the entire depth of the pancreas. You're leaving a small rim posteriorly, but you want to clear the disease in the pancreatic head. You have, again, to be careful about SMV injury. And you can see the SMV sort of lurking right there behind the core cavity. Sometimes I'll use intraoperative ultrasound to try to gauge the thickness of the fibrosis in that location, try to prevent getting too close to it. The other trick, and I learned this from Dr. Bell, who I think is in the back of the room, was to secure the bleeding branches from the GDA and the SMA and the pancreatic arteries using vicryl stitches that you place around the periphery of that core cavity. Post-op bleeding, when you have those vessels kind of bathing in the pancreatic juices, is a legitimate problem, and that can be something that's very helpful. The sort of final hybrid procedure is the FRI procedure, which combines a coring of the pancreatic head and an opening of the pancreatic duct down into the tail of the pancreas, and is useful for patients that have a head dominant pathology and have significant dilation and potentially multifocal stricturing along the length of the pancreatic body and tail. This provides excellent palliation, is similar to the burn in terms of its risks of postoperative bleeding and pancreatic insufficiency. And the pearls with this one, I think, are that you want to open up that lateral PJ as long as you possibly can. You don't want to leave the potential for distal stricturing out on the tail of the gland, so you really have to uncover the entire length of the pancreas. You have to make sure you see the pancreatic duct. You can use ultrasound or finder needles to help you do that. But you really want to extend the length of that pancreatic ejectionostomy out as far toward the hilum of the spleen as you can. Tips about lateral PJ, just one thing I really wanted to say is that, you look at these patients and you think because they're pancreatic fibrosis, they're not going to leak, and they usually don't. But you can't neglect, I think, the importance of doing a good pancreatic ejectionostomy for them. What I tend to do is full thickness bites with an inner running layer of Vicryl on the pancreas. And I think it's twofold important. It is hemostatic, one which I think is relevant, and the second is it tends to keep your pancreatic ejectionostomy open, and I think minimizes risks of stricturing and closing of the cavity over time. These procedures have been compared in prior studies. Marcus Buechler spent 15 or 20 years, I think, studying outcomes from these operations and was able to show us that they're all really comparable to one another in terms of their ability to improve quality of life and to treat pain. There were some minor morbidity differences when you compared the resectional operations to the drainage and hybrid drainage procedures, with the resectional operations having higher rates of, or higher degrees of intraoperative blood loss, and having patients stay about a day in the hospital longer than the patients that were treated with drainage procedures, but their long-term outcomes over years of follow-up were very comparable. And that kind of brings us to the final question, which I think is one of the million-dollar questions in all of this, is when do we do these surgeries, given the fact that our GI colleagues are becoming so talented and have so many weapons at their disposal? When do surgeons actually step in? Which I think is a question that really doesn't have a very good answer right now. If you look at all of the studies that have been done that have compared outcomes between endoscopy or endotherapy and surgery, surgery always comes out as one which provides more durable pain relief for these patients. There's no debate about that. The most recent large series that I've seen is the North American Pancreatitis Study 2 group, which longitudinally followed about 500 patients and looked at 353 that went through surgery and 200 that went through endotherapy, and again, the surgically treated group had much more of a much higher rate of durable pain relief. The counterbalance to that, I think, has always been the risk of the operation, the incisions that you have to give patients, the potential for bleeding, you know, those sorts of things, and the fact that surgically treated patients tend to have a higher rate of exocrine insufficiency in many of the trials that compare the outcomes between these two general approaches. I will point out that probably has something to do with the fact that we're just seeing patients on the surgical side later than the endoscopic side, but it's still a legitimate concern. This is going to be a completely unuseful slide to you. It looked terrible to me, but basically this is every study that has been done that has compared endotherapy to surgery, and these numbers on the right side of the screen tell you consistently that the surgically treated patients tend to do better than the endoscopically treated patients with regard to pain relief, but have higher rates of exocrine insufficiency. So the key takeaways, I think, are that, you know, when you're thinking about someone who potential candidate for surgery for chronic pancreatitis, you can't think too carefully about addiction. You end up spending an incredible amount of time managing those issues if you're taking good care of those patients over time. And if you don't have a patient who is capable of, or a system who is capable of managing those problems, you just shouldn't be doing surgery for those patients. Technical considerations, you fit the morphology of gland with the procedure that we have to treat it. And I think the comparative results justify sort of earliest surgical intervention. And what I tend to do is to, you know, make it a discussion between the surgeon and the endoscopist. And once we've seen the patient on the surgical side, if we're gone through 2 to 3 rounds of endotherapy or ESWOL and we're not making the kind of progress that we want to see, or we're a year, 2 or 3 years into it and they've had a couple of rounds of stents with intervening months of feeling good, you know, I really pushed to try to encourage people to consider surgery. I think that's it. I just wanted to acknowledge, I've had the incredible fortune of working with a bunch of people who are the great minds in pancreatitis. I don't consider myself one of them at this point. I know Dr. Bell is in the back of the room, and I just wanted to say thank you to all those people who have been there for me.
That was great, Marshall. Thank you very much.